The jurors, who had been so relentlessly bored the entire day before, were wide awake and eager to witness this unexpected twist in the case. Many of the spectators shifted to the far right side of the courtroom for a better look at the screen. The lights went low. The movement stopped. Everyone seemed to take a deep breath, and then the tape began to roll. After Jared Wolkowitz and Lucian gave their introductions, Ansel appeared. He said, "This is my story, but I really don't know where to start. I'm living here in Juneau, but it's not really my home. I have no home. The world is my home, and I've seen most of it. I've been in some trouble over the years, but I've also had a lot of fun. Lots of good times. I joined the Navy when I was 17, lied about my age, anything to get away from home, and for 15 years I was stationed all over the place. I fought in the Pacific on the USS Iowa. After the Navy, I lived in Japan, Sri Lanka, Trinidad, so many places I can't recall them all right now. I worked for shipping companies and lived on the oceans. When I wanted a break, I settled down somewhere, always in a different place." Off-camera, Lucian said, "Tell us about Seth." Seth was 5 years older, and it was just the two of us. He was my big brother, and he always took care of me, as best he could. We had a tough life because of our father, Cleon Hubbard, a man we hated from the day we were born. He beat us, beat our mother, seemed like he was always fighting with someone. We lived way out in the country, near Palmyra, on the old family farm, in an old country house that my grandfather built. His name was Jonas Hubbard, and his father was Robert Hall Hubbard. Most of our other relatives had moved to Arkansas, so we didn't have a lot of cousins and kinfolks around. Seth and I worked like dogs around the farm, milking cows, chopping cotton, working in the garden, picking cotton. We were expected to work like grown men. It was a tough life, what with the Depression and all. But like they always said, the Depression didn't bother us in the South, because we'd already been in one since the war. "How much land?" Lucian asked. "We had 80 acres. It had been in the family for a long time. Most of it was in timber, but there was some farmland my grandfather had cleared. Cotton and beans. And the Rhines family had the adjacent property." "That's right. Sylvester Rhines. And there were some other Rhineses there, too. In fact, Seth and I played with a bunch of the Rhines kids from time to time. But always when Cleon wasn't looking. Cleon hated Sylvester. Hated all the Rhineses. It was a feud that had been boiling for a long time. You see, Sylvester owned 80 acres, too, right next to our land, to the west of it, and the Hubbards always felt as though that land belonged to them. According to Cleon, a man named Jeremiah Rhines took title to the property in 1870 during Reconstruction. Jeremiah had been a slave, then a freed slave, and somehow purchased the land. I was just a kid and never really understood what happened back then. But the Hubbards always felt like it was their rightful land. I think they even went to court over it, but at any rate, it remained in the Rhines family. This infuriated Cleon, because he had only 80 acres, but yet these black folks had the same. I remember hearing many times that the Rhineses were the only blacks in the county who owned their own land, and that they had somehow taken it from the Hubbards. Seth and I knew we were supposed to dislike the Rhines kids, but we usually had no one else to play with. We'd sneak off and go fishing and swimming with them. Toby Rhines was my age, and he was my buddy. Cleon caught Seth and me swimming once with the Rhineses and beat us until we couldn't walk. He was a violent man, Cleon. Vengeful, mean, filled with hatred, and with a quick temper. We were terrified of him. Because it was his third viewing that morning, Jake didn't focus as hard. Instead, he watched the jurors. They were frozen, mesmerized, absorbing every word as if in disbelief. Even Frank Doley, Jake's worst juror, was leaning forward with an index finger tapping his lips, thoroughly captivated. "What happened to Sylvester?" Lucian asked. "Oh, yes. That's what you want to hear. The feud got worse when some trees got cut near the property line. Cleon thought they were his trees. Sylvester was sure they were his. Because the boundary line had been disputed for so long, everybody knew exactly where it was. Cleon was ready to blow a gasket. I remember him saying he had put up with their crap for far too long, that it was time to do something. One night, some men came over and drank whiskey behind the barn. Seth and I sneaked out and tried to listen. They were planning something against the Rhines bunch. We couldn't tell exactly what it was, but it was obvious a plot was being hatched. Then one Saturday afternoon, we went to town. It was hot, August, I think, 1930, and everybody went to town on Saturday afternoon, blacks and whites. Everybody had to shop and stock up for the week. Palmyra in those days was nothing but a farming village, but on Saturdays, it was packed. The stores and sidewalks were crowded. Seth and I didn't see anything, but later that night, we heard some kids talking about a black man who had said something smart to a white woman, and this had everybody upset. Then we heard that the black man was Sylvester Rhines. We rode home in the back of the truck with my parents in the front, and we knew something was about to happen. You could just tell. When we got home, Cleon ordered us to go to our rooms and not to come out until he said so. Then we heard him arguing with our mother, a bad argument. I think he hit her. We heard him drive away in his truck. We pretended to be asleep, but we were outside in a flash. We saw the taillights of his truck headed west, towards Sycamore Row. Where was Sycamore Row? It's not there anymore, but in 1930, it was a small settlement on the Rhines land, near a creek. Just a few old houses scattered around, leftover slave stuff. That's where Sylvester lived. Anyway, Seth and I put a bridle on Daisy, our pony, and took off bareback. Seth had the reins. I was holding on for dear life. But we rode bareback all the time, and we knew what we were doing. When we got close to Sycamore Row, we saw the lights from some trucks. We got off and led Daisy through the woods. Then we tied her to a tree and left her. We went on, closer and closer, until we heard voices. We were on the side of a hill, and looking down, we could see three or four white men beating a black man with sticks. His shirt was off, and his pants were torn. It was Sylvester Rhines. His wife, Esther, was in front of their house, 50 yards or so away, and she was yelling and crying. She tried to get close, but one of the white men knocked her down. Seth and I got closer and closer until we were at the edge of the trees. We stopped there and watched and listened. Some more men showed up in another truck. They had a rope, and when Sylvester saw the rope, he went crazy. It took three or four of the white men to hold him down until they could bind his hands and legs. They dragged him over and shoved him up into the back of one of the trucks. "Where was your father?" Lucian asked. Ansel paused, took a deep breath, then rubbed his eyes. He continued, "He was there, sort of off to the side, watching, holding a shotgun. He was definitely part of the gang, but he didn't want to get his hands dirty. There were four trucks, and they drove slowly away from the settlement. Not far. To a row of sycamore trees. Seth and I knew the place well because we had fished in the creek. There were five or six tall sycamore trees in a perfect row. Thus the name. There was an old story about an Indian tribe planting the trees as part of their pagan rituals. But who knows? The truck stopped at the first tree and made a semicircle so there would be enough light. Seth and I had crept along in the woods. I didn't want to watch, and at one point I said, 'Seth, let's get out of here.' But I didn't move, and neither did he. It was too awful to walk away from. They strung the rope over a thick branch and wrestled the noose around Sylvester's neck. He was twisting, yelling, begging. 'I ain't said nothing, Mr. Burt. I ain't said nothing. Please, Mr. Burt, you know I ain't said nothing.' A couple of them yanked the other end of the rope and almost pulled his head off." Lucian asked, "Who was Mr. Burt?"
Ansel took another deep breath and stared at the camera in a long, awkward pause. Finally, he said,
"You know, that was almost 59 years ago, and I'm sure all these men have been dead for a long time. I'm sure they're rotting in hell where they belong. But they have families, and nothing good can come from naming their names. Seth recognized three of them. Mr. Burt, who was the leader of the lynch mob. Our dear father, of course. And one other. But I'm just not going to give names."
"Do you remember the names?"
"Oh, yes. I'll never forget them, as long as I live."
"Fair enough. What happened next?"
Another long pause as Ansel fought to compose himself. Jake looked at the jurors. Number three, Michelle Still, was touching her cheeks with a tissue. The other black juror, Barb Gaston, number eight, was wiping her eyes. To her right, Jim Whitehurst, number seven, handed her his handkerchief.
"Sylvester was practically strung up, but his toes were still touching the bed of the truck. The rope was so tight around his neck, he couldn't talk or scream, but he tried to. He made this awful sound that I'll never forget, sort of a high-pitched growl. They let him suffer there for a minute or two, all of the men standing close and admiring their work. He danced on his tiptoes, tried to free his hands, and tried to scream. It was so pathetic, so awful."
Ansel wiped his eyes with the back of his sleeve. Someone off camera handed him some tissues. He was breathing heavily.
"God, I've never told this story. Seth and I talked about it afterward for days and months, and then we agreed to try and forget about it. I've never told anyone else. It was so awful. We were just kids. We couldn't have stopped it.
After a pause, Lucien asked,
"So what happened, Ansel?"
"Well, the obvious.
Mr. Burt yelled, 'Go!'
And the guy driving the truck lurched forward. Sylvester swung, kind of wild at first. The two men on the other end of the rope pulled some more, and he shot up another 5 or 6 feet, I guess. His feet were about 10 feet off the ground. It wasn't long before he became still. They watched him for a while. No one wanted to leave. Then they tied the rope off and left him there. They drifted back toward the settlement, which was probably a tenth of a mile away from the tree. Some of the men were walking, some in trucks. How many total? I was just a kid. I don't know. Probably 10. Continue. Seth and I were creeping along in the trees, in the shadows, listening as they laughed and patted themselves on the back. We heard one of them say, 'Let's burn his house.' And the mob gathered close to Sylvester's place. Esther was on the front steps holding a child. A child. A boy or a girl? A girl. Not a toddler, but a little girl. 'Did you know this child?' 'No, not then. Seth and I found out about her later. Sylvester had only one child, the girl. And her name was Lois.' Letty gasped so loud that she startled most of the jurors. Quince Lundy handed her a tissue. Jake glanced over his shoulder at Portia. She was shaking her head, as stunned as everyone else. Lucien said, 'Did they burn the house?'
'No.
A strange thing happened.' Cleon stepped forward with his shotgun and stood between the men and Esther and Lois. He said no one was burning the house. And the men got in their trucks and left. Seth and I took off. The last thing I saw was Cleon talking to Esther on the front steps of their little shack. We hopped on our pony and sprinted home. When we sneaked through the window to our room, our mother was waiting. She was angry and wanted to know where we had been. Seth was the better liar, and he said we'd been out chasing fireflies. She seemed to believe us. We begged her not to tell Cleon, and I don't think she ever did. We were in bed when we heard his truck approach and park. He came into the house and went to bed. We couldn't sleep. We whispered all night. I couldn't help but cry, and Seth said it was okay to cry, as long as no one else saw me. He swore he wouldn't tell anyone that I was crying. Then I caught him crying, too. It was so hot, and these were the days before air conditioning. Long before daybreak, we sneaked out the window again and sat on the back porch where it was cooler. We talked about going back to Sycamore Row and checking on Sylvester. But we really weren't serious. We speculated about what would happen to his body. And we were certain the sheriff would come out and arrest Cleon and the other men. The sheriff would need witnesses. And that's why we could never breathe a word of what we'd seen. Never. We did not go to sleep that night. When we heard our mother in the kitchen, we sneaked back to bed, just in time for Cleon to walk in and yell at us to get to the barn and milk the cows. We did that every morning at dawn. Every morning. It was a tough life. I hated the farm. And from that day on, I hated my father like no child has ever hated a parent. I wanted the sheriff to come get him and take him away forever.
Off camera, Lucian seemed to need a break himself. He paused for a long time before continuing with,
"What happened to the Rhines families?"
Ansel dropped his head and shook it in an exaggerated way.
"Awful. Just awful. The story gets worse. A day or two later, Cleon went to see Esther. He gave her a few bucks and made her sign a deed to the 80 acres. He promised her she could stay there. And she did. For about 48 hours. The sheriff showed up all right. He and a deputy and Cleon went out to the settlement and told Esther and the other Rhines folks that they were being evicted immediately. Pack up your stuff right now and get off his land. There was a small clapboard chapel, a church where they had worshipped for decades, and to prove he owned everything, Cleon torched it, burned it to the ground to show what a big man he was. The sheriff and the deputy helped him. They threatened to torch the shacks, too.
And you saw this?
Sure. Seth and I missed nothing. We were supposed to be chopping cotton. But when we saw the sheriff pull up in front of our house, we knew something was up. We were hoping he would arrest Cleon. But that's not the way things worked in Mississippi back then. Not at all. The sheriff was there to help Cleon clean up his land and get rid of the blacks.
What happened to the blacks?
Well, they left. They grabbed whatever they could and ran into the woods.
How many?
Again, I was a kid. I wasn't counting. But there were several families of Rhineses living on the land. Not all around the settlement, but they were fairly close to each other.
Ansel took a deep breath and mumbled,
"I'm really tired all of a sudden."
Lucian said, "We're almost finished. Please, continue."
"Okay. Okay. So, they were running away into the woods. And as soon as a family vacated their shack, Cleon and the sheriff would set it on fire. They burned everything. I vividly remember some of the blacks standing at the edge of the woods, holding their kids and whatever possessions they could grab, and looking back at the fires and the thick gray smoke and crying and wailing. It was just awful."
"What happened to them?"
"They scattered. For a while, a bunch of them were camping beside Tutwiler Creek, deep in the woods near the Big Brown River. Seth and I were looking for Toby, and we found him there with his family. They were starving and terrified. We loaded up the horses one Sunday afternoon, sneaked away and took as much food as we could steal without getting caught. That was the day I saw Esther and her little girl, Lois. The kid was about 5 years old and completely naked. She had no clothes. It was just awful. Toby came to our house a couple of times and hid behind the barn. Seth and I gave him as much food as we could. He hauled it back to the campsite, which was several miles away. One Saturday, some men showed up with rifles and shotguns. We couldn't get close enough to hear anything. But our mother told us later. They went to the campsite and ran off all the Rhineses. A couple of years after that, another black kid told Seth that Toby and his sister had drowned in the creek and that some folks had been shot. I think by then I'd heard enough. Could I have some water?
A hand slid a glass of water to Ansel, who sipped it slowly. He continued,
"When I was 13, my parents split. It was a happy day for me. I left with my mother and went to Corinth, Mississippi. Seth didn't want to change school, so he stayed with Cleon, though they rarely spoke to each other. I really missed my brother. But after a while, we naturally grew apart. Then my mother remarried a jackass who was not much better than Cleon. I ran away when I was 16 and joined the Navy when I was 17. Sometimes I think I've been running ever since. Once I left, I never had any contact with my family. My head is killing me. That's all. That's the end of a really bad story."
Chapter 47. The jurors filed silently out of their room and followed the bailiff down a back stairway to a side door of the courthouse, the same route they had taken every day since Tuesday. Once outside, they scattered without a word. Nevin Dark decided to drive home for lunch. He did not want to be around his colleagues at that moment. He needed time to digest the story he had just heard. He wanted to breathe, to think, to remember. Alone in his truck with the windows down, he almost felt dirty. Maybe a shower would help. Mr. Burt. Mr. Burt. Somewhere on the shadier side of his wife's family tree, there had been a great uncle or a distant cousin named Bert. Many years ago, he lived near Palmyra, and there had always been whispers about Bert's involvement with the Klan. It couldn't be the same man. In his 53 years in Ford County, Nevin had heard of only one other lynching. But he had almost forgotten the story. It supposedly happened around the turn of the century. All witnesses were dead, and the details had been forgotten. Nevin had never heard a description of such a killing by a real witness. Poor Ansel. He looked so pitiful with his little round head and oversized suit, and wiping tears with a sleeve. Disoriented by Demerol or not, there was no doubt Seth knew what he was doing. Michelle Still and Barb Gaston had no plans for lunch, and they were too emotional to think clearly. They jumped into Michelle's car and fled Clanton, taking the first road out with no destination in mind. The distance helped, and after 5 miles on an empty county road, they were able to relax. They stopped at a country store and bought soft drinks and crackers, then sat in the shade with the windows down and listened to a soul station out of Memphis.
"We got 9 votes, Michelle asked. "Girl, we may have 12. "Nah, we'll never get Dolly. One day I'm gonna slap his ass. Might be today, might be next year, but I'll do it."
Michelle managed to laugh, and their moods were lifted considerably. Jim Whitehurst also drove home for lunch. His wife was waiting with a stew, and they ate on the patio. He had told her everything else about the trial, but he did not want to replay what he had just heard. But she insisted, and they hardly touched their lunch. Tracy McMillan and Faye Pollan drove together to a strip mall east of town, where a new sub shop was doing a booming business Their juror buttons got a few looks, but no inquiries. They got a booth so they could talk, and within minutes were in complete agreement. Seth Hubbard might have been fading in his final days, but there was no doubt he planned things perfectly. They had not been too impressed by Herschel and Ramona anyway, and they didn't like the fact that a black housekeeper would get all the money, but as Jake had said, it was not for the jurors to decide. It wasn't their money. For the Hubbard family, a morning that had begun with such promise had turned into a humiliating nightmare. The truth was out about their grandfather, a man they'd hardly known, and now their family name would be permanently stained. They could learn to handle the stain, but losing the money would be a catastrophe. They suddenly wanted to hide. They sprinted to the home of their host out by the country club and ignored lunch while debating whether they should return to the courtroom. Letty and Portia returned to the Sappington place during the break, but there were no thoughts of lunch. Instead, they went to Letty's bedroom, kicked off their shoes, and lay side by side, holding hands, and began to cry. Ansel's story had closed so many circles. With so many thoughts swirling around, there were almost no words. Emotions were too high. Letty thought of her grandmother, Esther, and the horror of the story, and her mother, a little girl with no clothes, no food, no shelter. "How'd he know, Mom?" Portia asked. "Who? Which one? Which story?" "Seth. How'd he know it was you? How did Seth Hubbard ever find out you were the daughter of Lois Rhines?" Letty stared at the spinning ceiling fan and couldn't begin to answer. Finally, she said, "He was a very smart man, but I doubt if we'll ever know." Willie Traynor stopped by Jake's office with a platter of sandwiches and invited himself to lunch. Jake and Harry Rex were upstairs on the balcony having a drink. Coffee for Jake, beer for Harry Rex. They appreciated the sandwiches and helped themselves. Willie chose a beer. He said, "You know, when I had the paper, somewhere around 1975, some guy published a book about lynchings. He did his homework, had lots of gory photographs and such, and it was a good read. According to him, and he was from up north and eager to make us look bad, between 1882 and 1968, 3,500 blacks were lynched in the United States. There were also 1,300 whites, but most were horse thieves out west. From 1900 on, almost all lynchings were of blacks, including some women and children." "Is this really appropriate during lunch?" Harry Rex asked. "I didn't know you had such a delicate stomach, big boy," Willie shot back. "Anyway, guess which state leads the nation in lynchings?" "I'm afraid to ask," Jake said. "You got it. We're number one at almost 600, and all but 40 were black. Georgia is a close second. Texas a close third. So I remember reading this book and thinking, 600 is a lot. How many were in Ford County? I went back 100 years and read every copy of the Times. I found only 3. All black, and there was no record of a Sylvester Rhines." "Who compiled these numbers?" Jake asked. "There have been studies, but you have to question their validity." "If they knew of 600, Harry Rex said, "you can bet there were a lot more." Willie took a swig of beer and said, "And guess how many people were charged with murder for taking part in a lynch mob?" "Zero,"
You got it. Not a single person. It was the law of the land, and black folks were fair game.
Kind of makes me sick, Jake said.
Well, old buddy, your jury's sick too, Willie said, and they're on your side.
At 1:30, the jurors reassembled in the deliberation room, and there was not a single word uttered about the trial. A bailiff led them into the courtroom. The large screen was gone. There were no more witnesses. Judge Attlee looked down and said,
Mr. Brigance, your closing argument.
Jake walked to the podium without a legal pad. He had no notes. He began by saying, This will be the shortest closing argument in the history of this courtroom, because nothing I can say could ever be as persuasive as the testimony of Ansel Hubbard. The longer I talk, the more distance I put between him and your deliberations, so I'll be brief. I want you to remember everything he said, not that anyone who heard it is likely to forget. Trials often take unexpected turns. When we started this one on Monday, none of us could have predicted that a lynching would explain the mystery of why Seth Hubbard left his fortune to Letty Lang. His father lynched her grandfather in 1930, and after he killed him, he took his land and scattered his family. And Ansel told that story far better than I'll ever be able to. For 6 months, many of us have wondered why Seth did what he did. Now we know. Now it's clear. Personally, I have a new admiration for Seth, a man I never met. In spite of his flaws, and we all have our own, he was a brilliant man. Who else do you know who could put together such a fortune in 10 years? But beyond that, he somehow managed to keep track of Esther and Lois, and then Letty. Some 50 years later, he called Letty and offered her the job. She did not call him. He planned it all, folks. He was brilliant. I admire Seth because of his courage. He knew he was dying, yet he refused to do what would have been expected. He chose a far more controversial route. He knew his reputation would be tarnished, that his family would curse his name, but he didn't care. He did what he thought was right. Jake stepped over and picked up the handwritten will. And lastly, I admire Seth because of his sense of justice. With this handwritten will, he is trying to fix a wrong inflicted upon the Rhines family by his father decades ago. It falls upon you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, to help Seth correct that injustice. Thank you. Jake slowly returned to his seat, and as he did, glanced at the spectators. Sitting on the back row, smiling and nodding, was Lucien Wilbanks. 3 minutes and 20 seconds, Harry Rex said to himself as he punched the timer on his watch. Judge Attlee said, Mr. Linnea. Wade was limping worse than usual as he made his way to the podium. He and his clients were watching helplessly as the money slipped away yet again. They had had it in the bag. As recently as 8 o'clock that morning, they had been mentally spending it. Wade had little to say at this urgent moment. History had suddenly and unexpectedly reared up and crushed him. However, he was a veteran who had been in tough spots before. He began,
one of the most important tools a lawyer has in the courtroom is the chance to cross-examine opposing witnesses. The lawyer almost always gets the opportunity to do this. But occasionally, like now, that opportunity is not available. And it's very frustrating. I feel handcuffed. I'd love to have Ansel here to ask him some questions. For example, I'd say, "Now, Ansel, isn't it true that you are now in the custody of the Juneau police?" And, "Now, Ansel, isn't it true you're under arrest for cocaine distribution and escape from custody?" And, "Now, Ansel, isn't it true that you're wanted by the authorities in at least 4 states for such things as obtaining goods under false pretenses, grand larceny, and non-payment of child support?" "And tell the jury, Ansel, why you haven't filed a tax return in the past 20 years. And the big one, isn't it true, Ansel, that you're all set to collect $1 million if Seth's handwritten will is declared valid?" "But I can't do that, ladies and gentlemen, because he is not here. All I can do is caution you. I caution you that everything you've just seen and heard from Ansel might not be all that it purports to be." For a moment, let's take Ansel out of the picture. I want you jurors to go back to last night. Remember what you were thinking last night? You left here after hearing some powerful testimony. First, by doctors with unimpeachable credentials, experts who've worked with cancer patients and understand the extent to which powerful pain medications disrupt one's ability to think clearly. Lanier then went through summaries of the testimonies of Drs. Sweeney and Niehoff. It was a closing argument, and much leeway was given for the art of persuasion. But Lanier slanted things so perversely that Jake was compelled to stand and say, "Your Honor, I object. I don't believe that's what Dr. Niehoff said." "Sustained," Judge Attlee said rudely. "Mr. Lanier, I'll ask you to stick to the facts." Stung, Lanier rambled on about what these fine doctors had said. They had taken the stand only yesterday. It was not necessary to replay such recent testimony. Wade Lanier was stumbling now and off his game. For the first time since the opening bell, Jake thought he looked lost. When he couldn't think of anything, he said repeatedly, "Seth Hubbard lacked testamentary capacity." He brought up the 1987 will, and much to Jake's delight, and much to the juror's dismay, he fleshed it out once more. $3.1 million wasted, just like that," he said, snapping his fingers. He described a tax ploy known as the Generation Skipping Trust, and just when juror number 10, Debbie Lacker, was about to nod off, he said again, $3.1 million wasted, just like that," and snapped his fingers loudly. It was a cardinal sin to bore jurors who were pinned down and required to listen. But Wade Lanier was pouring it on. Wisely, though, he did not attack Letty Lang. Those listening had just learned the truth about her family. It would not be wise to belittle or condemn her. As Lanier took a painful pause to assess his notes, Judge Attlee said, "You might want to wrap this up, Mr. Lanier. You're over the time limit." "Sorry, Your Honor." Flustered, he offered a sappy thanks to the jury for their
wonderful service, and concluded with a plea for faithful considerations, free from emotion and guilt.
Rebuttal, Mr. Bergantz? Judge Attlee asked.
Jake was entitled to 10 minutes to counter anything Lanier had said. As the lawyer for the proponent, he got the last word, but he wisely declined.
No, Jan, I think the jury has heard enough.
Very well. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I need to spend a few minutes and instruct you as to what the law is and how it applies in this case, so listen carefully. When I'm finished, you will retire to the jury room and begin your deliberations. Any questions?
The waiting was always the worst part. A great load was lifted after the jury retired. All the work was finished. All the witnesses had testified. All the worrying about opening statements and closing arguments was over. Now the waiting began. There was no way to predict how long it would take. Jake invited Wade Lanier and Lester Chilcott to his office for a drink. It was, after all, Friday afternoon, and the week was over. They opened beers on the balcony upstairs and watched the courthouse. Jake pointed to a large window in the distance.
That's the jury room, he said. That's where they are right now.
Lucian showed up, ready as always for a drink. He and Jake would have words later, but at the moment, the mood demanded alcohol. With a laugh, Wade said,
Come on, Lucian. You gotta tell what happened in Juno.
Lucian gulped down half a beer and started talking. After everyone had either coffee, a soft drink, or water, Nevin Dark called their little meeting to order and said,
I suggest we start with this verdict worksheet that the judge has given us. Any objections to that?
There were none. There were no guidelines on jury deliberations. Judge Attlee said they could figure things out themselves.
Nevin said, Okay, here's the first question. Was the document signed by Seth Hubbard a proper holographic will in that it was, one, written entirely by Seth Hubbard, two, signed by Seth Hubbard, and three, dated by Seth Hubbard? Any discussion?
Ain't no doubt about that,
Michelle Still said. The others agreed. The contestants had not argued otherwise. Nevin continued,
Next, and the big one, testamentary capacity or sound and disposing mind. The question is, did Seth Hubbard understand and appreciate the nature and effect of his holographic will? Since this is what the case is all about, I suggest we each take a turn and say what's on our minds. Who wants to go first?
Faye Pollan said,
You go first, Nevin. You're juror number one. Okay. Here's what I think. I think it's wrong to cut out the family and give all the money to another person, especially someone who Seth knew for only 3 years. But as Jake said at the beginning, our job is not to decide who should get the money. It's not our money. Also, I think Seth was slipping in his last days and was pretty doped up. But after seeing Ansel, I have no doubt he knew what he was doing. He had been planning it for a long time. I'm voting in favor of the will. Tracy?
Tracy McMillan said quickly,
I agree. So much about this case troubles me, but so much of it I'm not supposed to worry about. We're suddenly dealing with decades of history, and I don't think any one of us should tamper with that. Seth did what he did for some very good reasons. Michelle,
Y'all know how I feel. I just wish we weren't here. I wish Seth had given Letty some money if he wanted to, then taken care of his family, even if he didn't like them. Can't say as I blame him, but I don't care how bad they are. They don't deserve nothing. Faye?
Faye Pollan evoked less sympathy than anyone else in the room, maybe with the exception of Frank Doley. She said,
I'm not too concerned about his family. They probably got more money than most of us, and they're young and educated. They'll be fine. They didn't help Seth make his money. Why should they expect all of it? He cut them out for a reason, reasons we'll never know. And his son didn't even know who played center field for the Braves. My God, we've been fans of Dale Murphy for years now. I think he was just lying. Anyway, I'm sure Seth was not a nice person, but like Jake said, it's not our business who he gives his money to. He was sick, but he wasn't crazy.
It was a two-beer deliberation. After the second, a clerk called and said there was a verdict. All laughter ceased immediately as the lawyers shoved gum in their mouths and straightened their ties. They walked into the courtroom together and took their places. Jake turned to the spectators and saw Carla and Hannah seated on the front row behind him. They smiled, and Carla mouthed,
Good luck.
Are you okay? Jake whispered as he leaned over to Letty.
I'm at peace, she said. Are you okay?
I'm a wreck, he said and smiled. Judge Attlee took the bench, and the jurors were brought in. It is impossible for a trial lawyer not to look at the jurors as they return with a verdict, though every trial lawyer vows to ignore them. Jake looked straight at Michelle Still, who sat down first, then gave him a quick little grin. Nevin Dark handed the verdict to the clerk, who handed it to Judge Attlee. He reviewed it forever, then leaned an inch or two closer to his mic. Enjoying the drama, he said,
The verdict appears to be in order. The jury was to answer five questions. Number one, did Seth Hubbard execute a valid holographic will on October 1st, 1988? By a vote of 12-0, the answer is yes. Number two, did Seth Hubbard understand and appreciate the nature and effect of what he was doing when he executed his holographic will? By a vote of 12-0, the answer is yes. Number three, did Seth Hubbard understand and appreciate who the beneficiaries are to whom he had given gifts in his holographic will? By a vote of 12-0, the answer is yes. Number four, did Seth Hubbard understand and appreciate the nature and amount of his property and how he wanted to dispose of it? By a vote of 12-0, the answer is yes. And number five, was Seth Hubbard unduly influenced by Letty Lang or anyone else when he executed his holographic will on October 1st, 1988. By a vote of 12-0, the answer is no. Ramona gasped and began crying. Herschel, who had moved himself to the second row, rose immediately and stormed out of the courtroom. Their children had left the trial the day before. Judge Attlee thanked the jurors and dismissed them. He adjourned court and disappeared. There were hugs among the victors and long faces among the losers. Wade Lanier was gracious in defeat and congratulated Jake on such a fine job. He spoke kindly to Letty and wished her the best.
If she was on the verge of being the richest black woman in the state, she did not look it. She just wanted to go home. She ignored a couple of reporters and brushed aside some well-wishers. She was tired of being pawed at and fawned over. Harry Rex organized a party on the spot, hot dogs on the grill in his backyard and beer in the cooler. Portia said she would be there after she took care of Letty. Willie Traynor was always ready for a party. Lucian said he would come early, and he might bring Sally, a rare occurrence. Before they left the courthouse, Lucian was already taking credit for the win. Jake wanted to choke him. Chapter 48. The sermon was the annual call to stewardship, the usual chiding to tithe a bit more, the challenge to step up and give the Lord his 10% and to do so happily. Jake had heard it 100 times and, as always, found it difficult to maintain prolonged eye contact with the Reverend while his mind dwelled on matters far more important. He admired the Reverend and labored diligently each Sunday to appear entranced by his homilies, but often it was impossible. Judge Attlee sat 3 rows up, at the end by the aisle, the same revered seat he had claimed for at least the last 10 years. Jake stared at the back of his head and thought about the trial, and now the appeal. With the verdict so fresh, the case would hit a brick wall. The process would take forever. 90 days for the court reporter to transcribe hundreds of pages of courtroom proceedings. 90 plus because they seldom delivered on time. Meanwhile, post-trial motions and maneuverings would take months. Once the final record was indeed final, the losers would have 90 days to file their appeal, and more time if necessary. When the Supreme Court and Jake received the appeal, he would have his own 90 days to respond. After the deadlines were met and the paperwork was on file with the court, the real waiting began. Typically, there were backlogs, delays, and continuances. The lawyers had learned not to ask what was taking so long. The court was doing the best it could. The average appeal in a civil case in Mississippi consumed 2 years. In preparation for the Hubbard trial, Jake had run across a similar case in Georgia that had dragged on for 13 years. It had been fought before 3 different juries, went up and down to the Supreme Court like a yo-yo, and was eventually settled when most of the contestants died off and the lawyers had taken all the money. The issue of the attorney's fees did not bother Jake, but he did worry about Letty. Portia had told him her mother had stopped going to church. There were too many sermons about tithing. If the collective wisdom of Harry Rex and Lucian could be trusted, Jake's verdict was in trouble. The admission of Ansel's video was a reversible error. The Fritz Pickering surprise was not as clear-cut, but would probably upset the Supreme Court. The witness dump pulled by Wade Lanier would attract a harsh rebuke, but standing alone, it would not get the case reversed. Nick Norton agreed. He had watched the trial on Friday and was surprised to see the video. He was deeply moved by its content, but bothered by its admissibility. The 4 lawyers, along with Willie Traynor and other experts, had debated and celebrated over hot dogs and beer until late Friday night while the ladies sipped wine by Harry Rex's pool and chatted with Portia. Though the Hubbard case had saved Jake financially, he was ready to move on. He didn't like the prospect of clipping the estate for a monthly fee for years to come. At some point, he would begin to feel like a leech. He had just won a big trial and was looking for another one. Not a single person at the First Presbyterian Church mentioned the trial that morning, and Jake was grateful. Afterward, as they mingled under two giant oaks and exchanged pleasantries while inching toward the parking lot, Judge Atlee said hello to Carla and Hannah and commented on such a beautiful spring day. He walked down the sidewalk with Jake, and when no one could hear them, he said, "Could you stop by this afternoon, say around 5? There is a matter I'd like to discuss." "Sure, Judge," Jake said. "And could you bring Portia with you? I'd like her insights." "I think so." They sat at the dining room table under a creaking fan that did nothing to cut the heat and stickiness. It was much cooler outside. The porch would have been nice, but for some reason the judge preferred the dining room. He had a pot of coffee and a platter of cheap pastries, store-bought. Jake took one sip of the weak and dreadful coffee, then ignored it. Portia declined it all. She was nervous and could not control her curiosity. This was not her part of town. Her mother might have seen some nice homes because she cleaned them, but never as a guest. Judge Atlee sat at the head of the table with Jake to his right and Portia to his left. After a few awkward preliminaries, he announced, as if on the bench and looking down at a pack of anxious lawyers, "I want this case settled. For the next 2 years, the money will be tied up while the appeal runs its course. Hundreds of hours will be spent. The contestants will make a strong argument that the verdict should be reversed, and I see their point. I admitted the video of Ansel Hubbard because it was the fair thing to do at that moment. The jury, and I suppose all of us, needed to understand the history. It gave meaning to Seth's motives. It will be argued forcefully that I was wrong procedurally. From a selfish point of view, I prefer not to be reversed. But my feelings are not important." Like hell they're not, Jake thought, as he glanced at Portia. She was staring at the table, frozen. "Let's suppose for a moment that the case comes back for a retrial. The next time around, you will not get blindsided by the Pickering matter. You will be ready for Julina Kidd, and most important, you will have Ansel here as an interested party and a live witness. Or if he's in jail, you will certainly have time to conduct a proper deposition. At any rate, your case is much stronger the next time, Jake. Do you agree?"
"Yes, of course."
"You'll win the case, because you should win the case. That's exactly the reason I allowed Ansel's video. It was the right and fair thing to do. Do you follow me, Portia?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"So, how do we settle this matter, stop the appeal, and get on with life?" Jake knew he had the answer and really didn't want much input. "I've thought of nothing else since Friday afternoon," the judge continued. "Seth's will was a desperate, last-minute attempt to correct a horrible injustice. By leaving so much to your mother, he was in reality trying to make amends to your great-grandfather and to all the Rhines families. Do you agree?"
"Agree, damn it, Portia, agree." Jake had been here 100 times. When he asks, "Do you agree?" he's already assuming that you agree enthusiastically. "Yes, sir," she said.
He took a sip of coffee, and Jake wondered if he drank the same wretched brew every morning. Judge Atlee said, "I'm wondering, Portia, at this point, what does your mother really want? It would be helpful to know that.
I'm sure she's told you. Can you share this with us?
Sure, Judge. My mother doesn't want a lot, and she has reservations about getting all that money. For lack of a better term, it's white folks' money. It doesn't really belong to us. My mom would like to have the land, the 80 acres, and she'd like to build a house on it, a nice house, but not a mansion. She's seen some nice houses, but she's always known she'd never have one. Now, for the first time in her life, she can dream of having a beautiful home, one she can clean for herself. She wants plenty of room for her kids and grandkids. She'll never marry again, although there are a few buzzards circling. She wants to get away and to live way out there in the country where it's peaceful and nobody will bother her. She didn't go to church this morning, Judge. She hasn't been in a month. Everybody's got their hand out. My mother just wants to be left alone.
Surely she wants more than a house and 80 acres, Jake said.
Well, who doesn't want some money in the bank? She's tired of cleaning houses.
How much money? Judge Antley asked.
We didn't get that far. In the past 6 months, she's never sat around and thought, okay, I'll take $5 million, and I'll give each kid $1 million, and so on. That's not my mother, okay? She doesn't think in those terms. It's just so far beyond her.
She paused for a second, then asked,
how would you divide the money, Judge?
I'm glad you asked. Here's my plan. The bulk of the money should go into a fund for the benefit of your blood relatives. Not a cash giveaway that would turn into a feeding frenzy, but a foundation of sorts that would be used solely for education. Who knows how many Reinsers are out there, though I'm sure we would quickly find out. The foundation would be tightly controlled by a trustee who would report to me. The money would be invested wisely and spread over, say, 20 years. And during that time, it would be used to help as many students as possible. It must be limited to a sole purpose, and education is the most likely. If it's not limited, then there would be 1,000 requests for everything from health care to groceries to housing to new cars. The money is not guaranteed, but must be earned. A blood relative who studies hard and gets admitted to college will qualify for funding. How would you split the money? Jake asked. Portia was smiling. In broad strokes, I suggest this. Let's work with the figure of $12 million. We know that's a moving target, but it'll be close. Fund the bequests to Ansel and the church at $500,000 each, down to 11. Take $5 million of that and place it in the trust fund I just described. That's a lot of tuition, but then we can anticipate a lot of kinfolks, both old and new.
They're still arriving by the carload, Portia said.
Judge Antley continued. That leaves $6 million. Split it equally among Letty, Herschel, and Ramona. Of course, Letty gets the 80 acres that was once owned by her grandfather.
Jake took a deep breath as the numbers rattled around. He looked across the table and said, Letty's the key, Portia.
Portia, still smiling, said, she'll take it. She gets a nice house and a nice cushion, yet she won't be hassled by a fortune everybody wants a piece of. She told me last night the money belonged to all of Sylvester's people, not just her. She wants to be happy, and she wants to be left alone. This will make her very happy.
How do you sell it to the rest of them? Jake asked. I assume Herschel and Ramona will be thrilled.
Who knows about Ansel and the church? Keep in mind, Jake, that I still control the estate, and I will for as long as I so choose. Not a dime can ever be distributed without my approval, and there is no deadline to close an estate. I'm sure no one has ever called me a jackass behind my back, but if I want to be one, I can sit on Seth's money for the next 10 years. As long as the assets are protected, I can keep them bottled up as tightly as I wish. He had slipped into his chancellor's tone, one that left little doubt Judge Reuben V. Antley was about to get his way. He continued, "Indeed, it may be necessary to keep the estate open indefinitely to administer the education trust we're talking about." "Who will run the trust?" Jake asked. "I was thinking about you." Jake flinched, then almost fled at the thought of dealing with dozens, maybe hundreds, of eager students clamoring for money.
"That's a great idea, Judge," Portia said. "My family would feel better if Jake stayed involved and kept an eye on the money."
"Whatever. We can work it out later," Jake said, on his heels.
"Do we have a deal?" the judge asked.
"I'm not a party," Jake said. "Don't look at me."
"I'm sure Letty will approve, but I need to talk to her," Portia said.
"Very well. You do that and get back with me tomorrow. I'll prepare a memo and float it to all the lawyers. Jake, I suggest you go see Ansel this week and get some answers. I'll schedule a meeting with all parties in about 10 days. We'll lock the door and hammer out a settlement. I want this to happen. Understand?"
They clearly understood. A month after the verdict, Ansel Hubbard sat low in the passenger seat of Lucian's old Porsche and gazed through the window at the rolling hills of Ford County. Of the land, he remembered nothing. The first 13 years of his life had been spent in those parts, but he had worked hard for the past 50 to forget them. Nothing looked familiar. He had been released on a bond arranged by Jake and others, and he had been cajoled south by his pal Lucian. "Just one last visit. You might be surprised." Thin gray hair was sprouting again and partially covered the ugly scar across the back of his head. He wore jeans and sandals, same as Lucian. They turned onto a county road and approached Seth's home. There was a for sale sign in the front yard. Lucian said,
"That's where Seth lived. You want to stop?"
"No." They turned again onto a gravel road and drove deeper into the woods.
"Recognize any of this?" Lucian asked.
"Not really." The woods thinned, and they came to a clearing. Ahead were cars parked haphazardly and people milling about, including some children. Smoke rose from a charcoal grill. Farther on, they approached overgrown rubble and ruins, all choked with kudzu. Ansel raised a hand and said,
"Stop, here."
They got out. Some of the others were nearby and walking over to say hello, but Ansel did not see them. He was looking away, far in the distance. He began walking toward the sycamore tree where they had found his brother. The others followed quietly. Some were left behind. With Lucian trailing closely, Ansel walked 100 yards or so to the tree, then stopped and looked around. He pointed to a small hill covered with oaks and elms and said,
"We were up there, Seth and me, hiding in the woods. It seemed farther away back then. They brought him here, under this tree. There were more trees back then, a whole row of 5 or 6, in a perfect line, along the creek here. Now there's only one. There was a tornado here in '68,
Lucian said from behind him.
"This is where we found Seth," Ozzy said. He was standing next to Lucian.
"Is it the same tree?" Jake asked. He was standing next to Ozzy. Ansel heard their voices and looked at their faces, but he did not see them. He was in a daze, in another time and place. He said, "I can't say for sure, but I think so. All the trees were the same, a perfect row. We fished right over there," he said, pointing again. "Seth and me, right over there." He exhaled heavily and seemed to grimace. Then he closed his eyes and shook his head. When he opened them, he said, "It was so awful." Lucian said, "Ansel, Sylvester's granddaughter is here. Would you like to meet her?" He took a deep breath and snapped out of his dream. He turned abruptly and said, "I'd be delighted." Letty walked over and offered a hand Ansel ignored. Instead, he gently took her shoulders and squeezed tightly. "I'm so sorry," he said. "I'm so sorry." After a few seconds, she unwrapped herself and said,
"Enough of that, Ansel. The past is the past. Let's say it's over. I want you to meet my kids and grandkids. I'd be delighted."
He was then introduced to Portia, Carla, Ozzy, Harry Rex, and the rest of Letty's family. Then he met Herschel Hubbard, his nephew, for the first time. They all talked at once as they left the tree and headed for the picnic. This is Michael Beck. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Sycamore Row by John Grisham. This program was directed by Tony Huds, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2013, by Belfry Holdings, Inc. Production copyright 2013, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.